Welcome to the Silver Screen Podcast. I'm Jared Boomer.
And I'm Katie Gainey West. This is a podcast about movies and pop culture.
And today we're reviewing the new movie Babylon, directed by Damien Chazelle, starring Margot Robbie and Brad Pitt in this particular movie. And we have a lot to say about this film. There's a lot going on in this movie. So lots to talk about with Damien Chazelle's 3-hour and 10-minute Babylon. So first, though, we have some recommendations on this episode. As we mentioned on the last episode, we recorded Glass Onion and Babylon on the same day. So we did news on that one. We're doing recommendations on this one. So, Katie, what do you have to recommend this week?
Well, I'm pumped to talk about Babylon. I feel like we have to majorly dissect the movie. So I'll keep this quick for you all. I do want to let everybody know I did make it to 100 books in 2022.
Congrats.
Thank you very much. It was the 11th hour. I tried to actually squeeze in a 101st book, but I didn't quite make it. So anyway, 100 books, great. Yes. So one of the last books I read that I really liked was called All the Dangerous Things by Stacey Willingham. I mentioned her earlier in the year. She had 2 books come out in the same year. I don't know how that happened. It could have been that one was published at the beginning of the year, but she wrote her debut book was at earlier in the year. And
oh,
I talked
okay.
about it.
Very cool.
And I loved it. But this was her follow-up. And I thought it was just as good. I read some Goodreads reviews from other friends who didn't feel the same way. But I think her books are great. They're thrillers. They're quite spooky. But if you're interested in that, All the Dangerous Things by Stacey Willingham. I think she has a long career ahead of her. And then the only other thing, I am trying so hard to catch up on TV and movies and things, but the holidays didn't allow for it because I had a lot of travel and stuff to do. But I watched season 5 of The Crown, finally got it done. I know some people like gobble it up and they get it done in like 48 hours. I cannot do that with The Crown. The Crown is a slow burn for me. It's been that way every season. But Diana... The portrayal of Diana keeps my attention like no other seasons. Elizabeth Debicki playing her, phenomenal. Like, wow, 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 wow. And I think this season, I don't like how much we like talk about her death and talk about how dramatic and sad it was and all that. I mean, it definitely was all of those things. But I will say this lead up to everything that was going on in her life, the demise of her marriage, her kids growing up, her feeling so isolated, like post her eating disorders and other things, is so interesting. And I thought season 5 was excellent. And I think my favorite episode was Gunpowder. If anyone, I think that was episode 8. I did watch the last 3 episodes I watched in the same day. I couldn't get enough. But Gunpowder was about Guy Fawkes Day. They talked about trying to blow up Parliament on November 5th. The 5th of November. And then they also talked about Diana doing her interview with Martin Bashir. I remember this happening in history. It was so crazy. So if you're interested in that, or if you haven't watched The Crown, I will say I am not as into it as some people, but I do love it, but it's always a slow burn. I have to like convince myself to sit down and watch it when it comes out, and I cannot binge it. I can binge almost any show and I cannot binge that show.
So, for me, in terms of recommendations, I did finish season 1 of White Lotus. So, I have completed it. I thought it was pretty good. I thought it kind of sputtered to the end. I thought like episodes 1 through 4 were great. Episodes 5 and 6 were okay. I thought the murder was kind of anticlimactic in the way that it happened. Did not know who was going to die though. So that was interesting. Kept me guessing till the end there. Excited to watch the second season. I've heard everybody's loving the second season in Sicily. So I will be checking out season 2 of The White Lotus on HBO. And then all I have to recommend is, this is not a show that is out yet, but looks interesting to me. I saw a preview for it today. It's called Pressure Cooker on Netflix. It's a cooking competition show, but they like all live in the same house as well while they're competing. Ooh. And like there's no celebrity judges, like they judge each other basically like on the food, but also like it seems like kind of Survivor, Big Brother vibes along with a good quality cooking show. So we'll see. I'm intrigued by the concept. I feel like cooking shows are either they're like wacky or they're super duper competition based. And I tend to like more of the competition based ones like Top Chef. That would probably be my favorite cooking competition show. but this one seemed interesting to me, so I'll be checking it out. I'll always be watching the first episode to see if it's any good. So
yeah, that sounds fun. I am not someone who's good at watching cooking shows, but because of my husband, I do watch quite I see quite a bit because he loves them. Jared, I was going to say, I know I mentioned this to you before, but White Lotus, even though I hate absolutely everyone with a fiery passion on the show, the second season to me was way better. Okay. I really enjoyed the second season a lot better than the first season. So hopefully you will.
Good to know.
I still hated everyone.
So those are our recommends for this week. No corrections, at least not in the 10 minutes since we've recorded the last episode. So we will now get into our review of Damien Chazelle's Babylon, released on December 23rd. Christmas release. Big move going against Avatar, but I think we'll talk about that in the box office numbers. It didn't work out as expected. Also, we should mention a parental warning for this movie. If you have kids listening with you, we're probably going to talk about some things that are not super duper appropriate. So,
and your kids probably shouldn't. This is a hard R.
This is a hard R. Yeah.
This movie is one of the hardest R's I've ever seen. I loved it, but it is a hard R.
This is like, this is even worse than Wolf of Wall Street in some areas. So,
I mean, yes, but I also loved Wolf of Wall Street. I think I like the chaos and the debauchery. I'm here for that. That seems to, I don't know if that's like, I shouldn't say it's like a kink, but if that's the direction this episode's going to go, I seem to really like movies like this, though. But yeah, get your kids out of the room if what I just said didn't scare them away already.
It's rated R for drug use, bloody violence, graphic nudity, pervasive language, strong and crude sexual content. And it has all those things. Do you think you like these type of movies? Because like you would never do like coke in real life. So seeing somebody doing coke is like invigorating.
Yes.
Like...
And these are the characters. I see what actors get to do. And I'm like, this is the role I would just kill to do. Like this, that's what I want. I want to like fake do coke. I want to like be in these orgies. I just want to be a lunatic and wear these like scantily clad outfits. That is what I want. Truly. I'm not even trying to be funny, everyone. Like this as an actor is what I dream of.
So this movie is 3 hours and 9 minutes. Another long one, but I feel like pretty justified in its runtime. We'll talk about that a little in likes and dislikes. And then IMDb 7.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes critics 55%. Audience 49%. So audience is not loving it. Again, I said on last week's episode at the end, I think you're either going to really like or really dislike this movie. Yes. Critics, I don't think like this movie because it's making fun of Hollywood in some aspects, especially critics of Hollywood and like the hobnob uppity ups of Hollywood in certain parts of this movie. So I could see critics being like, oh, they're disparaging the cinema. How dare they?
I love that you said uppity ups. That was so cute.
Yeah.
I love that, the uppity ups.
So this box office has made $10.7 million. It had an $80 million budget, one of the bigger flops of the year.
That hurts.
I don't think releasing it at the same time as Avatar was a good move. And I just think that Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie are obviously stars. They can get people to the theaters, but did not do so for this one. I do think, though, that this is one to be watched on the big screen. I think there's some cool sequences in it that are demanding of actually going and seeing it in a theater. So,
Now, if you're worried about the graphic sexual content, maybe watch it on a tiny screen. But if you're like, I'm here for this, let me see what
If you want the ability to fast forward, then wait till it comes on streaming. Yeah. But The synopsis, a tale of outsized ambition and outrageous excess, it traces the rise and fall of multiple characters during an era of unbridled decadence and depravity in early Hollywood. So like Katie said, this is set during the 20s, the roaring 20s, before the Great Depression obviously happens in the 30s. It's also the time period where Hollywood is transitioning from silent movies to movies with sound. So that's another big plot point throughout the film. So this is directed by Damien Chazelle. He's a young director, but has done some of our favorite movies, known for Whiplash, First Man, and La La Land. So he's worked with Gosling, Trice, Brad Pitt, Miles Teller, J.K. Simmons, Margot Robbie. I mean, he's kind of hit the heavy hitters.
I heard a rumor. I mean, it was a trivia fact I read on IMDb, so I don't know if it's true, But it said that Emma was actually set to play Nellie first.
Oh, okay. Instead of Margot Robbie.
Scheduling conflicts. Okay. Yes. So I don't know if that's true. Now, I have a lot to say about Margot and her performance. I don't think I could have seen Emma doing this.
No, I don't think it would have worked as well.
That's just me. Because I think Emma is stunning. I love her. I have such a crush on her. But I think Margot's hot. Mm-hmm. I think Margot's the person you want to see. In this movie. I don't know what is coming out of me in this episode. If you guys came to hear me trash this film, you're not going to get it. I really enjoyed it. I can definitely justify what I liked. So stay tuned. But Margot, I love her.
Back to Damien Chazelle before we get to Margot Robbie. He's been nominated for several Oscars, including Best Adapted Screenplay for Whiplash and Best Directing and Best Original Screenplay for La La Land. And in 2017, he won Best Director for La La Land. That was the year that La La Land thought they had won Best Picture for about 20 seconds. And then we found out Moonlight actually won Best Picture. So the whole cast of La La Land was like headed up to the stage, and then Warren Beatty couldn't read the freaking envelope correctly. And
so sad.
Maybe we shouldn't have 90-year-olds do the biggest category of the night. Just saying. We fixed that at this year's Oscars. Best Picture was announced correctly, but we had the slap. So, you know, maybe next year's Oscars will be. And then the previous two Oscars were COVID. So maybe this year's Oscars will be.
Yeah, maybe this one's going to be normal. Really calm.
Yeah, we'll see. Something huge will probably happen. So no upcoming projects listed yet for Damien Chazelle. We'll see what he decides to work on next. Most of his movies, except for with the exception of First Man, have some aspect of music in them as well. Whiplash, La La Land, Babylon all have a musical element to them. So that's one theme he likes to kind of carry through his movies. So we'll take a break here on the show. We'll come back. We'll talk about the cast and our likes and dislikes for Babylon. Okay, we're back here on the show talking about Babylon, a movie about 1920s Hollywood. Margot Robbie plays Nellie LeRoy in the film.
Jared, if you could just lay on that crush alert button, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. So Margot Robbie, I have already fangirled just a little bit. We talked about her recently on episode 164 when we reviewed Amsterdam. She's an Australian actress best known for Suicide Squad, I, Tonya, Birds of Prey, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and The Wolf of Wall Street. She's been nominated for two acting Oscars for her roles in Bombshell and I, Tonya. She has many upcoming projects, including Asteroid City, which I think we mentioned in Glass Onion.
Mm-hmm.
I forget who that was, but somebody else.
Edward Norton, correct?
Oh, yeah. I think you're right. Okay. She's also going to be in Greta Gerwig's Barbie. And this was on IMDb, an untitled Margot Robbie's Ocean's 11 film. So I don't know what that's about.
So this new Wes Anderson movie does have a stacked cast, the one that Margot Robbie is going to be in. So Margot Robbie, Edward Norton, Bryan Cranston, Steve Carell, Tom Hanks, just to name a few of the people that will be in that film. So
wow, that is so good. Get me two tickets. I'm ready to go see Asteroid City. Thank you so much. Cool. And well, I can't wait.
Next. Yeah, so this should be good. And then the Ocean's 11 movie I'm interested in, too. So
yeah, I don't know what that was about. And when we had done Amsterdam, that wasn't on there yet. So I don't know.
Okay.
Who knows what that's about? Then next up, we have Diego Calva. He plays Manny Torres. I really debated a crush alert here, but don't let that sway you from me. Like, I was so impressed by him. So I think he's beautiful, but I'll forego the crush alert this time. Diego Calva was born in Mexico City in 1992. He is very well known in Mexico already. He's done a lot of work, and his previous work includes I Promise You Anarchy, Unstoppable, and The Inmate. Next up, he will star in Sleeping Dogs Lie, Bonded, and Midnight Family. And although I couldn't find a lot about those films, I do think because of this movie and this exposure, we're going to see him more in American films.
Yeah,
but I was very impressed with him personally. Then we have Jared. If you could just get ready for that crush alert, just lay on it again for Brad Pitt. Again, I think we all know how I feel about Brad Pitt based on that. He plays Jack Conrad in this film. We talked about him recently, too, in episode 158 when we reviewed Bullet Train. He is an actor and producer best known for Moneyball, 12 Monkeys, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Ad Astra, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Bullet Train, The Big Short, Seven, Meet Joe Black, and Inglourious Basterds. He is also a very respected producer. I didn't realize this until yesterday, Jared. His production company, Plan B, is like he's produced a lot of films through that. But overall, he's produced over 70 films already.
Wow. So, okay.
Amazing.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. He's been nominated for 7 Academy Awards, and in 2014, he won for producing 12 Years a Slave when it won Best Picture. And in 2020, he won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And next up, he will star in an untitled Joseph Kosinski project, which I thought you'd be very excited about, Jared.
Yes, I am a big fan of Joseph Kosinski, so we'll see what this Joseph Kosinski Brad Pitt movie does. I mean, sounds good. So,
and then this movie is also starring a gazillion people, but I'll just highlight a few. Jean Smart, Olivia Wilde, Flea, Tobey Maguire, Max Minghella, Samara Weaving, Catherine Waterston, Olivia Hamilton, and Lee Joon Lee.
Also, going back to Brad Pitt's production company, Plan B, he has been nominated for a Best Picture Oscar, I believe, 9 times. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yes, 9 times. And his company has won 3 of those, 12 Years a Slave, Moonlight, and The Departed. So
Brad Pitt,
pretty impressive.
I mean, listen, some of the tabloid fodder I've read makes me uncomfortable. But I think if you're just looking at his work, and because currently I don't know fact versus fiction with his life and everything, just based on his work, I'm very, very impressed by him.
I will also say that his production company, and I appreciate this, does interesting films. Does a lot of true stories, but just historical things, very interesting types of movies that his production company is working on. Now, his production company did throw some money behind Blonde earlier this year.
Yeah, that was bad.
Best move.
You can't hit them all. You can't win them all.
Also worked on She Said and that Woman Talking movie, which is supposed to be in theaters.
Yes, and
soon,
he does,
so, yeah.
It seems like he does a lot of like women-centered movies, movies about people of color or anybody that's not white. So he really, I think he puts his money where his mouth is and like really tries to get exposure for people and topics and stories that need it. So good for him.
So
and
before
he's
we move,
beautiful.
Oh, yes. So,
it just needed to be said.
So before we move on to our likes and dislikes, we have fact versus fiction. This was a Variety article called Babylon, the Myths and True Stories That Inspired the Classic Hollywood Epic. So we have some things about what was actually realistic in the movie and what was kind of made up for movie's sake. So
yes. Well, mainly I wanted to say this time period through the movie, we did mention a lot of it is before the Great Depression, but some of it movies did keep getting made. So this movie, they show a couple like title cards and stuff of different times, but it's supposed to take place roughly between 1926 to 1933. Mainly I wanted you all to know who is based on real characters or like what they're based on, because I think that's the most interesting part of the story. And what I liked, I had said that I suspected I would like this about the film, is that it was, some of them were based on real people, but also some of them were totally made up. And I thought that was an interesting way to go about it. So Nellie is loosely based on Clara Bow, who had a wild childhood. I think Margot Robbie said the worst childhood she'd ever read about. But it sounds like almost everybody from that time period had a really horrific childhood. So that's not saying much, but if you read anything about Clara Bow, very sad. She was from New Jersey. However, she didn't have drug addictions. So that's a big departure from the character in the film, but I'm sure they had to make it interesting. Jean Smart's character is based on Eleanor Glynn, who was a very famous writer at the time. I didn't look if she was a gossip columnist, but she was definitely known. Olivia Hamilton's character is based on the famed director Dorothy Arzner, who directed Clara Bow in The Wild Party. So she, there really was like a female director that I think was very similar to that person in the movie. Manny's character, that's who Diego Calva plays, he drew inspiration. There were some suspicions about this, like they didn't say it was absolutely based on this, but he drew inspiration from Rene Cardona, who acted in Mexico. There was also Eddie Mannix, who was known for being a fixer in Hollywood. He sounded notorious. He sounded like he was kind of known for all the wrong things, but could kind of get anything and everything done in Hollywood. But the power in this article, it said the power that he has in the movie is kind of outlandish for that time period. No matter how good he was still a Mexican-American actor. So he just wouldn't have been treated the same way as a white person.
Well, and he like rose so fast throughout
so
the movie.
So fast. I mean, like with little to no obstacles.
With no movie making experience before. And like, I know that thing can happen, but like it was a little unrealistic how he went from like production assistant to freaking head of the studio in like 3 hours. So
Now I did find this to be interesting. There was a Mexican American actor who did have a romance with Clara Bow. So that could have been the inspiration for Nellie for their relationship. Pitt's character mostly resembles a man named John Gilbert. They also said he could have been inspired by Clark Gable and a couple other people that you would know. I did, but they said John Gilbert was the most closely aligned. However, John Gilbert, spoiler, everyone, there are going to be spoilers. John Gilbert did not in any way commit suicide, but he was an extremely heavy drinker and he died, I think it was at the age of 39 from, that's not funny, I'm sorry, complications from all alcoholism. So he was going hard in the paint.
Yeah.
And he died.
Yep.
Lady Fay Zhu, this was to me the most interesting, fun thing. Lady Fay Zhu was based on Anna May Wong. This is who was played by Lee Jun Lee. She was the first Asian American to appear on U.S. currency. She was likely bisexual as well, and she did have to compete. She was in a movie with Marlena Dietrich, and she did experience some racism and things, so ultimately went elsewhere, but she did rise to fame. For real,
okay.
In America, which is cool. I thought that was such an interesting story because I would kind of assume that character was like, oh, no way people were nice to her. And it seems like she actually was pretty well respected at the time. So that's cool. And the currency thing was really interesting. Almost to the end here, Sidney Palmer's character is indicative of Duke Ellington. That was the black trumpet player in the film. I really liked his character. I was really impressed. I had never seen the actor before. But Duke Ellington, obviously very, very famous, famed musician. So I thought that was interesting because I didn't even put that together at the time. I kind of was thinking, who was this based on? So Duke Ellington. And then the only person that was real in the entire film that's 100% based on a real person, Max Minghella's character, he played Irving Thalberg. He was the only real person in the movie. He was a studio head, like exec person. And then just in general, I think a lot of people think this movie seems crazy, outlandish, unrealistic. Of the many, I think I probably read 6 articles about this, and most of them are from really reputable sources, like .org.gov or CNN or Time, you know, Variety. There was confirmation that there was a ton of excessive drinking, drug use, orgies, and more during that time period. The movie thrives on excess, and by all accounts, it seems like it's pretty accurate. And Damien Chazelle kept saying he wanted to portray that excess and how crazy it was. There were a couple things I read about that we'll talk about. That they said it's unlikely that it was kind of as chaotic as a couple things portray in the film. But as far as like the excessiveness of everything and people going to a house in the desert to go have major orgies and just do coke off tables, like that was pretty normal. That's true. So yeah, crazy times.
Yeah. Wild times. So before we get into our likes, I think we should talk about that opening sequence, the party scene, because
it's
I think
40 minutes.
Yeah, I think if you can make it through that, you can make it through the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But I could also see on the other side, if you come to me and you say, Jared, that was too much for me. I couldn't do it. I would say, completely understand, totally get it. And I don't fault you at all for that, because I think there is a lot happening during that party sequence. So first things they do is obviously take that elephant up the hill and try to get it to the party.
Very upsetting.
Yes.
Very upsetting, but no animals were harmed during the making of this film.
Yes.
So that's great.
I think it was even a CGI elephant. I'm pretty
sure.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it looked like it. So
outstanding. Okay.
I don't know. I'm not 100% sure, but it kind of looked like computer generated. So,
okay.
But then, you know, I think, like I said, I think if you can get through that party sequence, you start to learn more about the characters, you start to learn kind of their backstories, what they're about, and you get interested in that. But I think that leads me into the likes, because I did really like that opening sequence. I thought it was just mesmerizing to watch with the music, with the way Chazelle shot it. You know, you have characters moving through the crowd. You're following a couple of different people through that sequence, including Diego Calva's character of Manny. You follow him. You follow Margot Robbie's character. But I thought it was shot very, very well. The music was on point. Obviously, crazy stuff is happening. But there's just some like mesmerizing moments during that opening sequence. Like when Margot Robbie is dancing, you can't look away. It's like it just mesmerizes you. And there's other things that happen. Yeah.
Off my face the whole time.
So I just think that was a very cool sequence. Now, a lot of crazy stuff is happening during that, but I think It really, like you said, captures the kind of what was going on in Hollywood at that time. And it is a wild kind of 30, 40 minutes, but I think it's very well done.
Yes. And also that 40 minutes, I think that's the most hard R part of the whole film. Mm-hmm. That's when you yep. see like naked men, naked women, orgies, people legitimately having sex in this. It's wild. Mesmerizing is a perfect term for it, Jared. It was absolutely mesmerizing. Oh, and before, while we're talking about that scene, the elephant was fake. You are absolutely right. There was no real elephant use. So that's great. Great news. And I'm shocked because I definitely thought that was real. So I'm like super impressed. Yes, that first scene, I watched that Variety special. I told you all the actors on actors with Carey Mulligan and Margot Robbie. And she talked a lot about the opening sequence. And Carey Mulligan was really like surprised by it and loved it. And a lot of the stuff Margot says is exactly how I felt. Like what she said in that interview. I think that first 40 minutes, I think of the words chaotic, mesmerizing, and just debauchery. It's just mm-hmm. wild. And I think it's supposed to make you feel like your heart's beating fast, like maybe you're on coke. Like, it's just crazy and nonstop action. And I remember distinctly, I saw this over a week ago, when that sequence ended, I like breathed a sigh of relief. Like, I was just kind of like, what? I felt like I hadn't been breathing for 40 minutes because it was so intense. But I loved it. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I love. So I thought that opening sequence was spectacular.
Yeah, I thought Chazelle did some really cool things with the camera there. He does a lot of one shot or one take sequences in that particular opening sequence where you'll follow a character and the camera will not cut for a while. He also does what I've called the like trademark Damien Chazelle camera move, which is like, pan the camera over to somebody really fast, pan it back to the other camera, pan it back really fast. He does that a couple times in the opening sequence. That's kind of, I mean, he did that in La La Land. He did that in Whiplash as well. That's kind of like one of his signature things. So,
yes.
But yeah, the opening sequence was definitely interesting and like you said, mesmerizing and very chaotic. So, yeah.
Well, you said it. You yeah, said the well, word.
You compounded on it. So, the cast is really great in this movie. Diego Calva, I had not seen him in anything before this. I thought he did a fantastic job as Manny. I really liked Brad Pitt, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I also thought this was maybe the best movie I've seen Margot Robbie in. I think this might be her best. This or I, Tonya, probably her two best performances. So
I thought this was great. I actually have a dislike of it. But I did. I thought she was exceptional, and I really don't. I cannot envision anybody else doing this part. Anyone right now, in Hollywood, and that's because she did such a good job. I really liked Lee Jun Lee. Like, she was outstanding, and I was impressed with how confident she seemed, sexually aware of herself. Like, she was stunning in this film, and I believed every word she said, every dance that she did. It was so believable. And Diego Calva blew me away. And I just thought that, Diego's eyes, like every time you saw him, you could see like the hopefulness. I believed that he was a hopeless romantic. I believed that he was a studio darling. I believed that he wanted to be famous and wanted it for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm. Another like for me is I kind of like the different storylines that are going on in this movie. They kind of contrast a little bit. Margot Robbie's character and Diego Calva's character, they are kind of on the up and up. They're kind of on the rise, whereas yes. Brad Pitt's character is the opposite. He's kind of hit the peak, and now he's getting a little older.
Yes.
He's not acting as well in these movies. When the sound thing comes into play, he's not great at reading his script with a lot of inflection or tone or anything. So he's kind of on the way down. So I thought that was interesting to kind of contrast that with. And obviously, by the end of the movie, everybody's kind of on the way down. But, you know, throughout the movie, they're going up, he's kind of going down. So I thought that was interesting from a storytelling aspect.
Yes. And to expand on that, one thing I liked is I felt like each of the characters had a story. All of them had a motivation. All of them had something they wanted. All of them, you could see the conflicts that they were facing. You could see their positive qualities and their negative qualities. And I think a lot of movies, that's what they're lacking, is that the characters there's a void. You don't really understand them. Nobody explains it. They don't wrap storylines up. And I didn't get that in this movie. It was so great how diverse the characters were. I mean, diverse as in like their backgrounds, like where they came from, what they wanted, their motivations. It was all really good. And another thing I liked, I didn't put this in the notes, but I really enjoyed how they showed how difficult it was to make movies before today. There was no shortcut to be found anywhere. So when they were doing these huge, there's one scene, they do this like epic film. It looks like something from medieval times, but they like, you know, they couldn't, there was no CGI. There was no fake anything that you could do. And especially when everything was going into color, it was even harder to find ways to show blood and mud and things like that. It was just so impressive, and it looked miserable. It looked awful. Like seeing the people, the extras that were just in the sun, where I kept thinking, where's their sunscreen? And then I thought, nobody cared then. Nobody even knew to care, but nobody was taking care of anybody. Whereas now a lot of that stuff just won't fly anymore. Like now we're worried about, you know, having people, having like counselors and people to help them with sex scenes. We're worried about, you know, do you have access to a therapist if you need it on set? The Bechdel test. Like there's a lot of care and concern. And back then they didn't do that for anybody.
Yeah. So another like I had was a couple things related to Brad Pitt's character.
Yeah.
I liked that when they were filming that sequence, I thought that was very cool. I thought that was a very funny sequence how Brad Pitt is basically drunk the whole day. Then they're finally ready for him. The camera, they've broken all their cameras, so they have to run and get another camera. Manny has to go get another camera, come back. Brad Pitt's like, now what? She's my ghost, right? Okay. He's like, you can tell he's drunk. He's about to throw up, and then just gets up there and like crushes this romantic end of movie scene that he's filming while the sun is going down with this actress in this medieval movie. I just thought that was funny. And he also has a couple of good speeches in this movie, like really well-written kind of monologues. There's one where he's talking about his, you know, wife that he's with at the time, which he goes through a couple in this movie. She's on Broadway, and he's talking about being in movies and how just so many more people see movies than Broadway plays, which I thought was interesting. Cause like when you think about it, just such a wider audience and many more people. So thought that was interesting. Some of the scenes he has with Manny, I thought were interesting. The part where you find out where one of his best friends unfortunately passes away. I thought that was a really impactful scene too. So I thought he had some really well-written character stuff in this movie. So
yeah. And Brad Pitt, we've seen him be charming before. I think that's something that is so natural. I think Brad Pitt in real life is probably just a very, very charismatic person. But so I've seen him play that before, but you're right. There was a depth to this character I probably haven't seen in a while from him. And it was interesting to see him play somebody who was really struggling internally with some like mental health issues, who had a serious addiction, which Brad Pitt has battled some addiction, especially with alcohol. So I think that was influenced by real life and experience. But that was really interesting to see, you know, what you even mentioned, like when stuff happened to his friends, and to notice that he was losing popularity and trying to figure out how to stay on top. That seemed very real to me.
Another like for this movie is the production design and the cinematography, which we already mentioned. Both were outstanding. The costumes in this movie are incredible. The sets are great. Everything fits a certain aesthetic very well. It looks great on screen. So
yes, and I think Damien excels in that. I mean, really, if you said, I'm not as good at knowing everything about directors, but if you ask me immediately, name your top probably three directors, Damien would immediately come to mind. I think of current day directors, I mean. He's so good, and he definitely has, like, his music. He always works with Justin Hurwitz. He always, you know, he definitely has, like, a vibe that he goes for. An aesthetic is probably a better way to say that, and he does it so well. He executes it well.
Music, that's going to be a like and a dislike for both of us. The main theme of this movie is really good. The one
amazing.
They use in the trailer, they use it during the opening sequence, during the party, they use it in the credits. It's a really great piece
of
music.
It's been an earworm in my head every single day since I've seen the movie. And the main, if you're looking, I listened to everything on iTunes, but Voodoo Mama is the main. If you're looking for it, that's the title track or whatever, or if you do the opening credits or whatever on iTunes. I agree with you, Jared. The main theme was like, it's just outstanding, and it's perfect for the time period too.
Yep. Yeah. So we'll talk more about music and the dislikes, though. Another like I had was the scene in this movie where they are shooting with sound for the first time. I thought it was so...
Oh, my God. That scene?
Yeah.
It was so good.
Yeah, I thought it was so good. It was so well done. It built a lot of tension. It was very interesting from a movie making, as somebody who's interested in like the movie making part of movies, to watch that play out. Everybody acted that scene very well. I just thought it was very, because they're doing this very simple thing where Margot Robbie like walks through a door, sets her suitcase down, and says about a paragraph of dialogue.
And then goes over to a desk and picks up a phone.
Yeah. And that's all this short scene is, but they have to do it so many times because they cannot figure out things. People keep opening the door to the studio. Somebody's making noise. Somebody sneezes. I mean, just little things in there that were so... well done. I thought, to build the tension, and you felt the frustration with them of like, you know, and then they do shoot the scene, and unfortunately you find out that the camera operator has died because it got too hot in the box that he was in, because he couldn't put the camera out because the microphone would pick it up. So yeah,
and it's not funny, but no. That scene, that's another one that I watched and I was like, I have wanted to be in movies and make movies and be an actor my whole life. If you said, what time period would you not have wanted to be in the movies? I would have said everything from this movie. Get me out of here. It looks so miserable, but I think that's part of the genius of it, is it convinces you like this was a miserable... people made money and they had, you know, riches and they had like these lavish lifestyles, but it also was genuine work at that time.
Yeah, it was hard. So,
yeah.
Okay. Last like is, this is obviously a movie about Hollywood, but yes, it's before the golden age of Hollywood. So yes, we get a lot of movies set during the golden age of Hollywood. Like,
yeah,
Mank is probably the most recent one.
And all those movies too, like that's when we saw, well, Gone with the Wind was in 39, but I feel like it's like Gone with the Wind, Singing in the Rain, and American Empire. I mean, a lot of the movies this movie is based on.
Yeah. Yep.
But all of those movies, Wizard of Oz, mm-hmm, you know, the one, Sunset Boulevard, All About
Eve. Alfred Hitchcock murder mysteries, yes, you know,
it, that was the golden age of Hollywood. This is based before. And I think that is so interesting because we never hear about this. I feel like we see things like Charlie Chaplin movies, which are exceptional. And then we go to like Gone with the Wind, and there, we don't hear anything in between and how difficult it was for people to make the leap from silent films to talkies. And also to make the leap to go from black and white to color. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was such an interesting concept. I loved it. I know that Jared and I both, me especially, I've harped on how I hate that the Academy only picks movies that are about movies or Hollywood. I don't like that they do that, and I don't think that should be the default. But I will fully admit that I am a lush for movies that are about Hollywood and making movies. I love them. I can't get enough. And I think that's why I identify so much with Damien Chazelle's visions.
So we'll move on to our dislikes now. Oh, one final like real quick. I just want to say, I thought Tobey Maguire was very good in this movie in a limited role. He plays a very sleazy slimeball character.
I thought he was so creepy.
Yeah, it's just something I haven't really seen from Tobey Maguire before. Yeah. So just wanted to give him props that it's a different role I haven't seen. Totally. I mean, obviously he plays Spider-Man, and then is kind of more of a charismatic character in a lot of movies. And this, he's the complete opposite. So I thought that was really some range from Tobey Maguire. So dislikes now. There's a couple of scenes that probably could have been cut because they don't really help the story. There's a scene at the party where Nelly is trying to behave. Obviously, I think this is one reason why critics don't like this movie. I think this is supposed to simulate, or be like, when you campaign for Oscars, you have to go to all these uppity up, you know, black suit events, tux events, whatever, and kind of just persuade Oscar voters to vote for you for the award.
It's a campaign. It's like a political campaign. They call it campaigning in Hollywood for those who don't know, it's literally like a political campaign.
I think that's what that scene is kind of simulating in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's could be why critics have maybe soured on this movie a little bit. But I agree with you, Katie, in the fact that it doesn't really aid much to the story. And it was kind of long. It's like 15 minutes.
It was really long.
Cut it out. So, yeah.
It was long, and I felt like it didn't really move the story along. I think it's great that you brought up the critics thing, because that didn't occur to me that that would be why critics didn't like it. I thought the thing was put in there just to see Nelly trying to behave, but I also was like, I don't need that. I like that Nelly is crazy. I mean, she's like coked out all the time and is a complete mess. And I like that about her. I don't need to see her like pretend to rein it in for 15 minutes. And the other scene, I don't know about you, Jared. I did not like the underground tunnel scene. I wanted to bring this up because I thought people would definitely not think this was real. The underground tunnel thing was real. There's definitely tunnels in LA like that were underground. They probably are still there. I didn't get that deep into it. But they said, and they definitely think orgies were happening down there and like people getting wasted and stuff. The article I read, which I think was another Variety article, but I could be wrong about that. But they were talking about the alligator thing might seem far-fetched, but they're like, there's nothing to really back it and saying, yes, 100% this happened. But that might have been more like Hollywood, like taking some liberties with it. But the tunnel thing, I thought that was interesting, but I thought going into this whole thing about Tobey Maguire, like needing money from them and then trying to kill them, that I was like, we're getting a little too far off of the story. And that he almost lost me. I mean, at that point I was like, oh no, I didn't come for this. This is not part of the story. So to me, the tunnel scene, the whole Tobey Maguire side story was my least favorite part of the whole film. I thought Toby was great in that part. And I even think you could have kept him in, but we didn't need, it was like 20 minutes.
Yeah. I would agree with you. We could have cut those two sequences and probably cut 45 minutes off the movie, or at least a half an hour.
Yeah.
So, also, as we mentioned, this is a very hard R, but it's a very hard R. So I can see if you said, this is too much for me, I don't want to watch this. I totally get it. I think that's one reason why it hurts its box office numbers, is that it's not just an R-rated movie. It's an R-rated movie with a lot of sex, a lot of drugs, a lot of swearing. And that will not appeal to everybody. So,
agreed.
Also, another dislike. So let's talk about the music for a second. Justin Hurwitz did the music for this movie, did the music for La La Land, Whiplash. Some of the music in this movie is great. Some of it sounds exactly like La La Land, like
Did you think that before I wrote it?
One of the songs sounds just like City of Stars from La La Land. Like, I was like, almost did exactly.
Did he copy paste and put it in here? And then part of me, I was so distracted by it during the film. I thought about it afterwards and I was like, maybe he did that. Like, maybe he wants to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he like wants us to remember La La Land, or maybe he's going to start doing this. And in every movie, there's going to be a little melody from another movie. I don't know, but I hated it. It made me so upset. It made me so distracted. And everybody knows I'm obsessed with La La Land. I love that movie. I have nothing bad to say about it, but I don't need to think about that when I'm seeing another great film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Threw me. And it also, that seemed to me like phoning it in. And I think Justin Hurwitz is an amazing composer, but I was like, why? Why are you doing this?
Yeah, I felt that same way. I noticed it was kind of very similar. So, and obviously, like when it's the same composer and the same director, you're going to get, if you do that, you're going to get even more comparisons than like if another composer maybe did something that sounded sort of similar. But when it's the same person that did the music for both movies, and then to like use music that sounds so much like La La Land. Yeah. So, go ahead.
Oh, I can combine two thoughts. Okay. I've kind of said this, but I can combine two of these things. Like, I just think where I would dock this points is I think this is a case of trying to cram too much in a movie. I get that this is supposed to be Damien's opus. He's like, this is my masterwork. I love movies. I love Singing in the Rain, which some people told me this was a retelling of Singing in the Rain. I do not agree with that at all. Like 0%. Do not agree with that. But I didn't want to hurt their feelings. But I think that if you cut, and I also think you can justify the runtime, even though, you know, we also don't like, you and I usually don't want super long movies. I can definitely handle them. I can justify it if you remove those two scenes. But I just think he was trying to do too much and that lost people a little, and that I can understand where people are docking at some points. I definitely don't think this is a 55 though. Ridiculous. No.
Another dislike for me, I did not like that ending montage of like, look at all this great cinema.
That is what I wanted to know about you. I thought, actually, when I saw your Letterboxd score, I was amazed because I thought for sure, I was watching the montage and I was like, Jared's going to hate this. So interesting. Yeah, okay, so you did not like it.
I did not like the montage.
Okay.
I just thought, we're doing this movie, and then to have at the end of this movie like this clip show of all these great movies that have come out, I just thought didn't really fit well. Then there's just like colors on the screen for like 30 seconds.
Drops of something. I think it was ink. I don't really know.
And okay, here's my thing too. If this had been a 2-hour and 15-minute movie, maybe I could have tolerated that. But I've already been in the theater for 3 hours, and then you're just going to slam clips of Avatar and, you know, color palettes on the screen for 4 minutes. Like, come on.
So I halfway agree with you. So I did want to say, I think it's important to note, in the theater, there were two people that got up during the montage. That was one of the last time. And I will say, I was like, you guys are ridiculous. You have sat through like 3 hours to the minute, and this is when you're getting up? Like, just sit the other nine. I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the one thing I didn't like about the montage, I agree with you. I don't need to see all the other great films or allegedly great films. I did like putting in the Singing in the Rain thing, because that scene especially where Gene Kelly, love of my life, was talking about the talkies and stuff, that did pertain exactly to this film. I thought that was interesting. It was a good scene to put in there. And then they had that Singing in the Rain thing was kind of like a jokey musical number in the film. That was relevant. That's fine. Yeah, I thought all of the visions at the end we didn't need. I did hate the ink drops or whatever it was. I was like, this is weird. I feel like I'm on an acid trip, and I've never been on acid. So I didn't like that. I had mixed feelings about it. I just think it could have been cut down and maybe just been the Singing in the Rain thing, and then it could have ended.
Yeah, I didn't mind the Singing in the Rain thing. I thought that was kind of like, he's been away from movies for so long. It flashes forward like 20, 25 years. He's got a family now. He goes to this movie, sees Singing. He hasn't seen a movie in a while. Watches Singing in the Rain, one of the greatest movies of all time. Feels a lot of emotion during it. I thought that was cool. But I did not need the sequence of here's all the great films that have come out throughout the history of the entire time that we've been making movies. I just thought that was not needed to be the end of this movie. So,
and then Jared, my last thing was, okay, I thought Margot was exceptional, but this is a hot take. For me right now that I'm saying this, she's going to win the Oscar. But in my opinion, Danielle Deadwyler in Till is still my front runner. Of the performances I've seen, Danielle should be given the Oscar for Best Actress. I could see Margot getting nominated. I could see Margot winning. But to me, I think Margot has so much to give and has really shown some range that she'll get an Oscar down the line. And I don't know that I want this to be the film she gets it for.
I think that's fair. So I'm looking at the odds right now on Variety.
But now that I said that, she's going to win. So they congrats, have her getting, Margo.
They have her getting nominated, but they do not have her winning.
Who do they have winning right now?
They have Michelle Yeoh from Everything Everywhere All at Once, followed by Cate Blanchett for Tar. So,
okay.
But they do have Margo making the cut. So I feel
she'll make the cut.
Yeah, I think she will get nominated, but I just don't think I see her winning. They have Danielle Deadwyler ahead of her, Michelle Williams for The Fablemans ahead of her. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So, okay, well, time to give our scores now for Babylon. What are you going to rate this movie?
Okay, I don't want to hear it from anyone who's a hater. I'm giving this 85. I know that critics are giving it 55. To me, even talking through it, it just reminds me, I feel like when I get amped like this, it's like, it's very clear that I feel for it. I would 100% watch this movie again. It's about Hollywood. It's about a topic I love. I think it was so beautifully done, well acted. It lost me a couple of times, but I thought it was a much more cohesive, well thought out, well done movie than most of the things I've seen this year.
Yeah, I'm going to go just a little bit lower than you and give it like an 83. Did enjoy it though. Few things, like you said, in our dislikes that I didn't love. I thought it was a little too long, dragged in a couple parts, but it was very interesting to watch. Very interesting story. I mean, for comparing 3-hour movies, I like this. I would watch this again over Avatar in like a heartbeat. So, you know, yeah.
Me too.
And I get to see Avatar at the end of this movie. So, you know, I get the best of both worlds. True. So, yeah, but I thought pretty well done. I could see, like I said a couple times, I could see why you would maybe not want to watch this movie. It's definitely one of those that can be divisive and can be difficult to watch. But I think the critics rating it so low is kind of surprising to me, because this is the type of movie that you think critics would love. A movie about Hollywood directed by a guy who's like one of the up-and-comers in Hollywood. Yeah. With big Hollywood stars, you think they would be all over it, but for some reason they're not. So.
I would rate it this highly no matter what, but Jared and I did record, like we said, Glass Onion tonight too, and it's crazy to me that Glass Onion is at a 93. And this is at a 49 for critics. Is that right? 49?
I think so. Or maybe a 59.
Yeah. But that's just insane to me because you cannot, I don't know. That's just wild. So I can't help but let that color my opinion a little bit just because that is so fresh in my mind as well.
Yeah. It's 55 on Rotten Tomatoes for the critics. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Okay. So on our next episode of the Silver Screen Podcast, we will be talking about A Man Called Otto, the new Tom Hanks movie based on the book by Frederick Bachman, A Man Called Uwe. They changed the title. Don't know why, but, also this movie had Oscar, aspirations, I think at the beginning of last year. And now they're releasing it in the middle of January, which is normally a death sentence for movies. So I'm expecting it to not be fantastic, but we are a Tom Hanks podcast. We support our boy, good projects, bad projects. We go out there and we see him. Yeah. So, I will,
I'm going to guess right now that it's not going to be good and I'm not going to like it. I'm going to say
I loved the book. So if
the book is one of the best books I've ever read.
Yeah. If the movie's not good, I'm going to be a little disappointed. So, yes, but that will be our next episode. And then we'll also be doing, after that, our favorite movies of 2022. We have a few more we need to see still, and then we'll be able to make our lists. And you can follow the Silver Screen Podcast on social media at Podcast Silver on Twitter and Instagram. Search us on Facebook, the Silver Screen Podcast. Follow us on Letterboxd. Be sure to rate and review wherever you listen to the show. And then on our next episode, we'll be talking about A Man Called Otto.
Until next time, we'd like to thank the Academy.